Hello, can you hear me? Hi, I'm Molly. So I wrote this weird stream of consciousness introduction for Nathan that I'm going to read in sort of a stunted autistic voice, just because I'm terrible at public speaking and I think that it'll be funny this way. I don't know, it might be really awkward, so don't feel bad if like it's just awkward for a couple minutes, because then Nathan will be really good and it'll be over soon. Okay. Nathan has a really cute son, a daughter, and a super cool hot wife and a basset hound. I know he has a basset hound because one time he tried to give me his basset hound. I was all, "What's wrong with your basset hound?" And he said, "Nothing." Nathan has some sort of job in the English department. I don't know what it is really, I just know he always has spreadsheets open on his computer when I visit him. There's a big cage in his office, which Nathan told me he keeps his son George in. Ha ha. George is really cute. They talk French at him, so he will grow up one day speaking French, which is so useful. Nathan was the first person I met when I arrived on campus for grad school in 2009. I had to ask him about registration or something. He told me to go upstairs and talk to Brigida, and I remember just standing there staring at him. I was all, "Is there anything else?" And he said, "Welcome to the program." I remember thinking, is everyone in this program so weird? And, you know, the answer is no. That first meeting was sort of a confrontation between two souls or whatever. Like, when you're as weird as I clearly am, and then you meet someone even weirder, it's a special moment. Let me also pause and say that besides it being a totally useless and nondescript word, I consider weird to be a great compliment. I sort of forgot about Nathan for a while, until a few months later I saw him do a reading at Perdita's house around Christmas time. Stephen Elliott was there on his book tour, and Perdita's husband did this great rendition of William S. Burroughs' Christmas poem, and it was a magical night, but I thought Nathan's reading was the best. I don't remember much about the content, except that it made frequent reference to anal sex. And it takes a special kind of courage to say anal sex over and over into a microphone. I didn't know there was going to be children here, but I mean, it's a bar, so that's your fault, I guess. Ever since that reading, Nathan and I became great friends based on a mutual hatred of bullshit and other fake, boring things. A year later, Nathan approached me in the English department lounge to tell me he wanted to go to MFA school, and I was all, "That's a really great idea." He said he got into a school in San Francisco where he's from, and of course Montana. Long story short, I said, "Shut up and stay in Montana." So that's why he's still here. You're welcome. I got to take classes with him for a year, and it was amazing. I loved having him in workshop because, I mean, he had valid and interesting things to say and all that, but he also wasn't afraid to fill silent voids with random, hilarious shit. I can't remember anything he said, but trust me, it was fucking funny. About Nathan's writing, you would not be familiar with any of his immediate influences. And by that, I mean that I have no idea where this shit comes from. His work is filthy and strange, and he uses weird sentences and italics for no reason. You'll be reading his story about a girl who shits on her boyfriend's pillow, and then all of a sudden men in suits come in and kidnap somebody from a nightclub, never to return. I was all, "Nathan, what is this doing in the story?" And he said, "I don't know, Molly, why don't you tell me?" His characters are troubled Californians from the wrong side of the tracks. Like I said before, he hates banality and rallies against it using the power of words and hyperrealism and satire. When he wants to make fun of a family for being boring, he describes their pantry as containing no salt, because salt would be too spicy for such a boring family. Nathan and his hot wife and cute kids and perfect basset hound are literally the best thing that has ever happened to Missoula in all of time ever. And I take full credit for him staying here and remaining such a relevant fixture in our culture. He is my very good friend, and I love him very much. More relevant to you and your experience here tonight, he's also a great reader and entertainer. Looks like I crossed out some stuff. Can't remember any. Please welcome to the stage, Nathan Irizarry.
Thank you, Molly Leitch, one of my great admirees. Pax Missoulana, Lux Veritas. Thank you for being here together at Second Wind. I'd like to wish a happy birthday to Casey Charles, Robert Mapplethorpe, and my daughter, Lux. She was born 1 year ago today in a tiny bedroom about 1 mile away from here. The same bedroom, the same bed that my son George was born in. This is a baby that won't be held back. And had I gotten home 12, 15 minutes later, I would have missed her entrance, egress. As it was, she literally fell into my hands. I didn't eat that morning. I carried this with me to work and then back to my home, this very egg. This very egg. Still perfect, perfect and beautiful. I just want you all to see this before I bury it tonight. Ritual. Relevance. Over the course of the next week after she was born, I wrote most of what I'm going to read tonight because workshop, like crime, never sleeps. I started it a few years before and I finished it about a month ago, but I wrote most of it during her first week on Earth. And I want to thank the people who helped me work it, Professors Deborah Magpie Erling, Dee McNamer, and David Gates. And my cohorts, although I take full responsibility for all wrong turns and transgressions. This piece is from my thesis, and if you like what you hear tonight, or if you don't like it, even if you don't like it, come to the MFA Winter Thesis Reading on December 7th at Burns Street Bistro. Bistro. This is lupus. Will had recreated himself before. During his first year of high school, he had transformed to a new cool. In the provincial shit town that was Santa Rosa in 1982, you had to make your own look or else have none. He had just seen Zoot Suit at the Phoenix, an indie movie house a town away. And though Susie and The Cure dominated his turntable, he had lately been listening to Look Sharp and had concluded that he needed to. He built his look in the full-length mirror in the bathroom. He knew he wouldn't be bothered. His mother barely got up off the couch anymore. He was as handy with a needle and thread as anyone. They'd all been pegging their own jeans for years, but he barely needed that. Salvation Army and Purple Heart had a lot of stuff from the 40s. Tuxedos worn once, pointy shoes, old man hats. Everyone else's garbage, treasured raw material to Will. His look had snap, angle, pop, like a Cholo Kandinsky. It was like no others. There was nobody else wearing vests, nice ones, with satin backs and pinstripes in front. Not like the dorks still in sweater vests from Sears. And with spats, He might as well be a spider from Mars, not that any of them knew the first thing about Bing. Also, unlike most kids at school, he was able to work a Van Dyke, however wispy. This helped. He was almost a foot under other boys, his age, and being snappy, natty, and pretty, he was a natural target. He took to carrying a straight razor, which matched his slacks. When he'd made his grand entrance into the living room, he got what he wanted. "What do you think?" He raised a cupped hand in the air and opened it like a dancer at the end of a routine. "You look sharp, Willie," his mother said, "real sharp." "Thanks, Ma. I like it a lot better than that rough look, the jeans and the holes and all those chains, like all your friends do. Clean." "Yeah. Where'd you learn that?" "Around." "What's that on your eyes, Mijo? Come closer. Let me see your eyes." "It's just eyeliner," as he walked to. She reached out to his arm and pulled. He leaned down and she kissed his cheek. "You're an angel, Willie. I wish your papa were here to see you. You want something to eat?" He did all the cooking now, and the shopping. He would take the money from her wallet and put back what was left each time, bring it home and make it up just like she had taught him. She'd always had a new batch of beans made from scratch each week. Now he. It was just the two of them since his brother Roman had moved out, his other brother Joaquin dead 2 years now. She could still cook if she really wanted to. All these aches and pains were bullshit. She'd been complaining for years. Headaches, chest pains, joints so sore she couldn't leave the house. It was all in her head. But what was he going to say? No one ever came around to see it. Since Alberta died, she didn't have any friends anymore. But she didn't need to do this. She was already on disability for her hip, so she wouldn't be getting anything for it. And he already loved her as much as anything. Santa Rosa. This was the supposedly idyllic setting where Hitchcock had come to film A Stranger Comes to Town. He had rented a fine Victorian family home with a picket fence for Shadow of a Doubt. Will had mad fascination for Joseph Cotten. That tightly curled hair, his commanding voice, the way he seemed to be standing 10 feet above you and a million miles away, but still present, looking down, aloft, aloof, and at the same time looking right into you. The director must have known that there are no real good old days. The stranger a metaphor for the enemy within, next door, where the underbelly turned up. It was supposed to be a sleepy little train town back then in the 40s, but there was never any perfect family paradise. Will knew kids whose families had been there since before it was even American, when it was still Mexico. Some of them had stories and they weren't about the good old days. In the old cemetery, the coolest place for night crawling, you could still find traces of some of the old, real Santa Rosa. It was preserved, would never be moved or tilled under, his mother had once said, because it was old in a white way, i.e. old but not that old, and mostly whites buried there, but not all. In a rare daytime visit, Will had found a headstone deep in some bushes marked Davis Wright, colored boy, died May 12th. 1865, aged 12 years. It wasn't any clean white slate 100 years ago, and it wasn't last year when they found a black man hanging from a tree in Juilliard Park. Now, Santa Rosa was worse than never the perfect little town. It was a suburban wasteland. In Rincon Valley, an area resettled in the 1800s by horse, 7-Elevens stood as sentry outposts at the corners of the neighborhoods, Nabot hoods. It was Automaton City, the city designed for leaving. The only clubs in town were over 21 wine bars with top 40 cover bands on small afterthought stages. And there were big hair metal bands at the other bars or at the fairgrounds. If you could catch a ride down to Cotati, there were a few good clubs with good shows. There was the occasional one-off in a rented hall, like when he went to see the Dead Kennedys and No Alternative and Black Flag at the Veterans Hall. None of it suited Will's tastes. He wanted Joy Division, Wall of Voodoo. He wanted noir. But there would be no birthday party in Soma County. So Will turned to his big brother to tap a dark vein of local post-punk that was making its own scene. Bands like Fire Mission were putting on shows in warehouses, living rooms, basements. Once, Diet Tribe played in an abandoned chicken coop in Petaluma. That was where he first met Roman's friend, Wolf. Sitting on a decayed wooden crossbeam, passing an adulterine bottle of whiskey. Wolf had cultivated the look. He wore a small beard along his straw jawline. His hair was tortured into a tarantula of dreadlocks, and he had woven small black ceramic and silver beads into some of them. There on that one by his ear, he had tied a dried chicken bone. Below, a bomber jacket with a thick sheepskin collar and the brown leather scraped and scratched and worn. His blue-gray eyes had playful sparkle, and when he smiled, his lips curled back from perfect teeth. It was curious that he hadn't seen her at any of the shows. Instead, he met her at school in his sophomore year. It was in the spring before the winter in which he would become new again, and he would owe it all to her. There was a March rain teasing, and the moisture in the air glowed with that painter's light Sonoma County was famous for. He spotted her from a distance. She was dressed like a witch, long black coat, pointy hat, but she was no witch. Michelle was a Wiccan and a wannabe blood drinker. He walked across the wet grass and right up to her, put out his hand. He knew this was important, especially with girls, to shake hands. The human contact, skin to skin, and the respect. Will Hansen. She looked him down to his pointy shoes and up again, stared him in the face and squinted one eye. Then she reached out and took his hand. Michelle Corners, but not for long. Okay. Will fingered a coin in his pocket. Where do you hang out? Cemetery, library, basement. I haven't seen you there at the cemetery. I only go on the full moon. That sounds good. I use a flashlight. They made fast friends. Soon Will was going with her on her moonly sojourns, more rarely there on his own, and they were otherwise often together. Days they would sit at the edge of the schoolyard. Her girlfriends became his. These friends would be important, for they would form the other 3 points of the five. One day in June, she raised it for the first time. It was twilight. They sat together cross-legged under a great oak at the junior college next to the high school. I'm forming a coven. I thought you weren't a witch. It's more of a family, but cemented in ritual and magic. She dipped into a Tupperware container full of her raw hamburger and rolled up a ball in one hand. Placed it gently past her lips. He waited for her to swallow. Is it just for girls? You pass, Will. It's 5 points and we need five. Of course, Michelle would be the leader of these she's and he. The others were obvious. Carrie, the cure baby, who carried her little rat in her shirt. Samantha, the death rocker with the big teased hair. And Stephanie, the one who only whispered. Stephanie had been transferred over to Ridgeway, the continuation school from Montgomery, under bad circumstances. Everybody knew her story about the boys. Wasn't she pretty and pink and all that? After 2 weeks of suspension, the boys were back at school and playing football again, and she was shuttled off across town. But they would all become new. In a renaming ceremony, their truer selves would reveal. That night, Will made tamales and pondered what he might become. This would be his creation story. At the end of the year, the true year, on winter solstice, the longest night of them all, they would circle in the cemetery and he would be born by candlelight, conditions being right. He almost told his mother about the coven. When he had talked to Michelle about keeping it hush-hush, she had said, "Secrets are suicide." But his mother was asleep in her chair. She was always tired, so he got to work. He put a pot on the stove, ran the onions and garlic, and got the meat going. He would use ground beef to save some time. Then he mixed up the masa. Then he went to get the corn. When he went to get the corn husks from the freezer, there was a container marked dog bones. It was a joke that his mother would never get, since she never got that far anymore. They had been there since Tinkerbell. When she had died, Will had said he had never wanted another Chihuahua. Lately, though, his heart had begun to warm again. Soon everything laid out. When the filling was done, he got to building. He had to pee, but kept working and waited. Then, with half of them finished, he needed to go bad. Will remembered when his mother had taught him tamales. She had said, "Go first, so we are ready. You never go to the bathroom in the middle." But he would wash his hands good. On his way back from the bathroom, as he passed the door to the living room, she called out to him, "Willie, I'm making tamales, Mom." "Good man, thank you." The kitchen smelled like corn. As he began to build again, he felt the dough sticking all to his fingers, a lot. They were too dry from the washing. It was clinging so much that his hands were coated. He couldn't roll the husks. So he just ran the kitchen faucet and rinsed off, put what he had in the steamer and scrapped the rest. He sat down on his favorite chair, the one with the big cushioned seat and the curly wooden armrests, and watched his mother sleep from across the room. She was in her easy chair, lit by the floor lamp and the candles burning on Joaquin's altar. Will had thought she'd been asleep the whole time he was cooking, but she'd replaced the votives and lit the new ones. It was the only thing she did anymore, but it always got done. Will had moved the altar from the bedroom so it could be closer to her all day. He'd emptied the wooden fruit crate and brought it out and set it on a small side table. Then he'd carefully arranged everything, the votive candles, a bowl of dry brown rice, the bowl of fresh water, the baby picture, the milagros, all the rest. He'd done a good job. It looked magical all lit up in the dark room. The light from the flames danced on her face against the warm backdrop of the lamplight. The red marks on her face looked almost as if they were suspended in the air just in front, as if a mask lifting off. It is winter solstice, 1983. The ritual beckons. The old cemetery sits on a wide wooded hill, no more than a great mound arisen from the valley floor. Wooded still, but now filled too with aging graves. It is surrounded by older streets with houses, some Victorian, but most much newer. Not so far a walk from the high school, 10 blocks, through residential streets where the canine packs have been domesticated and dispersed across backyards and howl together now only to the sirens. Past living room windows that flash the colorful washes of RGB. Past the new section of sprawling green open lawn like golf course with fresh burials where people might still leave flowers, down the sidewalk street along tall wrought iron bordering through the great gate. Here lies a dark forest of crypts and tombs and great stone crosses and headstones leaning now, cut by carriage-wide pathways through thickly oaked chaparral. They walk through the cool crisp two and in two, through the hole in the fence by the great gate, lettered finely Gothic overarching above, locked below, Will sauntering two beside and then falling in behind little Michelle. Behind them, Carrie, queen of the rats, Samantha in her Krakatoa cloud of clove smoke, and the one-time cheerleader, Stephanie. Deep in his right front pant pocket, Will carries a small hard droplet of red wax taken from Joaquin's altar. Passes through after Michelle, who is chugging blood-red wine from a bottle, will drink just until she can no longer feel her lips, and preaches to herself quietly, drinking now with conviction and preparation for the ritual. Darker Michelle, who can see the living eyes of the angel statues as they follow. He turns back to see Cyrus's small furred black head, bead eyes peeking out from the collar of Carrie's coat, longing. Will's arms ache to hold his own baby, little baby familiar, and at that moment, he can future feel his little Chihuahua Damien squirming about at his breast inside his tail top coat. Climbing up the dirt path, they walk directly into Roman and his friends, Wolf, Max, Tony, those cute older boys from out in the Russian River's redwood forest, art punk death rock, all now conjuring music and such at the JC, obsessed with the German as much as the English Bauhaus 1919, and other such starknesses, all dressed in all black and tatters, leathered and jackbooted, roaming in pointy black cowboy boots, but not in a cowboy way. As they stand stopped together, soon clear that they are all frying hard, Wolf red-faced and Roman giggling, and then through the night running up and down the paths, a pack of wild lost boys appearing out of and disappearing into the dark shadows, as if in dream, running and leaping one after the other from a great stone slab, arms waving, and he can fantasy see himself flying in with them out of the dark sky and down into the pool of a street lamp and landing. They run past while he is standing next to a crypt peeing into the bushes, a public restroom of the dead. And he watches Wolf running down the wide path in his tight jeans, and he can imagine the two of them, he and he, both scurrying hurriedly into the bush to hide from the cops, marching menace to the tender night with their two bright maglite light beams scanning, and ending up in their haste, together behind the same bush, pressed up against a tomb's cold stone wall, standing close by necessity for the too tight hidey place, and closer still as the bulls pass, and then feeling Wolf's hard dick against his hip through the two layers of jeans, but neither able to move, stopped still lest they be caught. Deeper into the forest, the coven forms for the cemetery ritual, the renaming ceremony, a remaking. You must die to that. Here where they would normally gather every full moon since summer, tonight to form the five-pointed circle again, ancient symbol of the feminine, Michelle had said. They sit on another granite slab, a family plot facing in, the candle dancing at their center, their bodies protect against a gentle wind. And so little Michelle, darkest of them all, this night becomes Dark Little Corners, aka DLC, aka Karen Scarlet Lord. Carrie would be Blade. Stephanie announces herself Raven, and the once blue-black Samantha, who already has a witch's name, pulls back her hood to unveil her long hair bleached blonde and declares that she will keep the name. Will Hansen, for his measure, will die this night, will feel himself rarefy and fly away and dissipate into the darkness. And as he sits in the circle and looks from each to each and finally says, Lobo, he can future feel the curved needle enter circle into each brow tip and grow small steel horns emerging and sharply shining from the holes, light rays from the temple.